somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation. Episode 33, The Counter-Revolution. Faced with bloody terrorism, democratic Europe has often reacted with tough responses. After the Charlie Hebdo massacre in 2015, French authorities convicted almost 400 people for glorifying terrorism. And France also adopted emergency laws to combat a wave of jihadist attacks. In the UK, the Counter-Terrorism and Border Security Act of 2019 criminalizes expressing an opinion or belief that is supportive of a proscribed organization if done in a way that is reckless as to whether it encourages support of terrorism. This makes it rather unnerving to jump into a Twitter thread and the age-old discussion of whether various groups are terrorists or freedom fighters. The Act also makes it a crime to watch or otherwise access information online that is likely to be useful to a person committing or preparing acts of terrorism. In other words, no terrorist intent is needed to convict someone watching a PKK or ISIS video. And following the proliferation of terrorist propaganda on social media, the European Commission proposed a new regulation in 2018. Tech companies like YouTube and Facebook must remove terrorist material within 1 hour or be punished with severe fines. Today, we'll see how governments in the late 18th century reacted to a different kind of terror. The spread of revolutionary ideas that shook the established order to the ground, including the actual terror unleashed after the French Revolution spiraled out of control. How would the supposedly liberal and tolerant Dutch react when the revolutionary ideas hit fever pitch in the 1780s? And could Britain maintain the delicate balance between order and liberty while holding at bay both the revolutionary ideas and armies of France? When the French Revolution broke out in 1789, Europe's royal families held their breath. In horror, they listened to the people's cries of death to the tyrants. From 1792, Europe's blue blood got a new reason for concern. In April, Louis XVI was bullied into declaring war on Austria and Prussia. By August, he was dethroned. And in January 1793, he was decapitated. Austria's new emperor, Leopold II, had especially good reasons to be afraid. His baby sister, Marie Antoinette, was right in the eye of the hurricane. Leopold set up a crisis meeting with the kings of Prussia and Saxony and called for a royal rescue team to restore the honor of His Most Christian Majesty. The crowns of Prussia, Russia, Saxony, Sweden, and Spain soon agreed. To quote Catherine the Great, "The affairs of France were the concern of all crowned heads, especially those that prefer to stay fixed to their necks." So governments all over Europe freaked out and started rolling back those Enlightenment reforms they had been duped into adopting. We've already seen how Catherine the Great reconsidered her liberal views on free speech and condemned seditious authors like Alexander Radishev and Nikolai Novikov to executions in Siberian labor camps. Frederick the Great died prior to the French Revolution, but as we saw in episode 30, his successor, Friedrich Wilhelm, was no friend of Enlightenment, with Immanuel Kant among those whose writings were censored in 1794. Maybe we shouldn't be too surprised that monarchs used absolutists rather than enlightened measures. But what about the governments of Britain and the Dutch Republic that had already adopted some of the principles that the revolutionaries were demanding? By now, we're used to thinking of the Dutch Republic as a haven of free speech in an otherwise repressive Europe. But the Dutch tolerance of controversial ideas did not rest on any positive law or charter securing press freedom. And as we've seen with Spinoza and Lemaître, post-publication censorship was far from uncommon in the 18th century Dutch Republic. From 1747 to 1797, at least 254 books were officially banned in the city of Amsterdam alone, including many by French Enlightenment thinkers such as Voltaire and Rousseau. The long arm of old regime France also reached across the borders to the Republic, and on at least 24 occasions between 1760 and 1785, the Dutch government took action against native journalists because of French complaints. In 1769, the Court of Holland even submitted a plan to introduce comprehensive pre-publication censorship in order to suppress ideas that undermined the foundations of Christian religion or Holy Scripture. The plan, however, caused massive outrage among the educated classes, who attacked the plan in writings and enlisted the bookseller, lawyer, and famous defender of free speech, Elie Lussac, to pen a fiercely critical rebuttal. You'll remember Lussac as the Calvinist publisher of Lemaître's scandalous work, Man, a Machine, and who wrote a principal defense of the rights to free speech of atheists back in 1749. Now Lussac had to do the good work once again. The plan, he argued, was both unworkable, unconstitutional, unnatural, and close at heart to the Dutch merchant state, hurtful to trade. Eventually, the authorities quietly abandoned the plan on the grounds of infeasibility. Discussions on the dangers and benefits of freedom of speech continued throughout the late 18th century, as loose ad hoc repression continued to be a government policy. In 1763, the Weekly Spectator, called The Thinker, published an article defending press freedom as a response to the English government's suppression of John Wilkes. And in 1769, a Dutch translation of a Wilkes essay on press freedom was published. But in the 1780s, the previously more academic discussions reached a revolutionary pitch with inspiration from America. A politician with a name straight out of Monty Python, Baron Johan Dirk van der Kappelen tot den Pol, took up the cause of the American revolutionaries, with whom he had friendly relations, corresponding as he was with John Adams. Van der Kappelen also translated Richard Price's pro-American independence work Observations on Liberty into Dutch. So fierce and outspoken were van der Kappelen's pro-American views that he was dubbed the Dutch John Wilkes. But his popular breakthrough came in 1781, when he anonymously published a 67-page pamphlet titled To the People of the Netherlands. In it, he accused the stadtholder regime of conspiring with England to suppress the ancient liberties of the Dutch. His pamphlet ended by echoing American views about the freedom of the press as being the only support for your national freedom. If one cannot speak freely to one's fellow citizens and warn them in time, it is only too easy for the oppressors to play their role. That is the reason why those whose behavior cannot endure any inquiry are always so much opposed to freedom of writing and printing and would like to see that nothing could be printed or sold without permission. The bulwark of liberty defense had made it to the Netherlands. And as if trying to prove Kappelen right, the States of Holland immediately banned the pamphlet. But despite the ban, van der Kappelen's pamphlet took the Netherlands by storm. Revolutionary cells of so-called patriots mushroomed everywhere. The patriots were intensely critical of the stadtholder William V of Orange and his perceived corruption. They demanded democratic self-government, an end to religious discrimination, and of course, complete freedom of the press. The rapid spread of the patriot movement across the Republic was fueled by the emergence in the 1780s of an often highly partisan Dutch language political press. Until then, political newspapers had been mostly written in French or German and reserved for the upper classes and foreign political exiles. But with the establishment in 1781 of the Dutch radical periodicals, the Post of the Lower Rhine and the Political Courier, a far larger part of the population were brought into political debates. Politics was no longer the exclusive domain of the rich and powerful, but something discussed by ordinary people in villages and towns throughout the Republic. The number of pamphlets from 1780 to 87 was enormous, numbering more than 2,300, compared to 375 in the preceding 8 years and less than 1,000 in the 8 years that followed. And the Patriot newspapers took up van der Capellen's line on free speech. "Without it, there would not remain a shadow of liberty," wrote one. The Patriot newspapers were far from neutral observers. They were fiercely critical of the government and portrayed the stadtholder as a drunken, tyrannical fool. In fact, the tone of Dutch patriotic newspapers got so fierce that none other than Elie Lussac found it a step too far. "Now this defender of free speech," thundered. "Newspaper writers who turn their liberty to relate the news into the impertinence of publishing everything that surfaces in their raging and sick brains are a disgrace to nature and the pests of society. They may with justice be regarded as the scum of the earth." Ironically, this broadside sounds a bit like the attitude of modern legacy media towards social media. And naturally, the Patriot Press was equally detested by the authorities, who regularly fined and sometimes even jailed editors. From 1783, the revolution grew more radicalized, as patriots all over the country established American-style militias known as Free Corps, threatening the regime. And from 1784 to 1787, a series of clashes erupted between Patriot Free Corps and the regime, resulting in the Patriots taking over the local governments in most of the important towns throughout the Republic, including Utrecht, The Hague, Leiden, and even Amsterdam. With the stadtholder exiled from his palace at The Hague and rival militias in control of separate cities, the Dutch Republic was on the brink of a revolutionary civil war. But the Dutch Republic was not only of local interest. Across the border, the newly crowned Prussian King Friedrich Wilhelm II, whose sister Wilhelmina was married to the Dutch stadtholder, watched the situation intensely. A staunch opponent of democratic ideals, Friedrich was extremely wary of letting the revolutionary spirit get out of hand. By the fall of 1787, he had had enough. Supported by Britain, the Prussians marched a rapid reactionary force of 26,000 men across the border, crushing what little resistance the Patriots could muster, and put William securely back in the position of stadtholder. But ironically, the fate of the revolution only proved the Patriots' suspicions were right to begin with. Now, indeed, the stadtholder had openly conspired with foreign powers to suppress the freedoms of the Dutch people. Back in power, William acted to eradicate the Patriot movement by dissolving the Free Corps and Patriot debating clubs, outlawing political meetings, and censoring the radical press. In 1789, that included banning van der Capellen's Dutch translation of Richard Price's pro-American treatise. To escape violent repression, tens of thousands of patriots found refuge in France, where Louis XVI welcomed them just as the Dutch had welcomed French Protestants fleeing the intolerance of Louis XIV after the revocation of the Edict of Nantes. The defeat of the Patriot movement at the hands of the Prussians did not mark the end of revolutionary activities in the Netherlands. But just as foreign military intervention had been crucial in ending the Patriot Revolution in 1787, it was foreign military intervention that kickstarted it 8 years later. This time, it was not conservative Prussians meddling, but the armies of revolutionary France. In 1795, French forces crossed into the Dutch Republic, cheered on by local revolutionaries, and replaced the stadtholder regime with a revolutionary state known as the Batavian Republic. It's perhaps ironical that just as the Dutch dark web had been central in fueling revolutionary ideas in France, to the constant dread of the old regime, now France was responding likewise by forcing its revolutionary ideas onto the Dutch. I guess here you could truly say, what you reap is what you sow. The Dutch Republic might have been the most tolerant state in Europe for much of the Enlightenment, but it was not until the French Revolution washed over its borders that freedom of speech was protected as a right of Dutchmen. The Constitution of the Batavian Republic in 1798 guaranteed that
every citizen may express and disseminate his sentiments as he sees fit, unless such would be contrary to the purpose of society. The freedom of the press is sacrosanct. provided that writings bear the name of the publisher, printer, or author. All these are at all times liable for any activities performed using a printing press that are defined by law as constituting a criminal offense, whether in regard to specific persons or in regard to society as a whole.
The various caveats in this formulation provided ample room for different interpretations as to what exactly would be contrary to the purpose of society and exempted from the otherwise sacrosanct freedom of the press. The press did remain to a large degree free, but there were several examples of the revolutionary government clamping down on publications they found contrary to the purpose of society. Scarcely more than a month after the revolution, the government, without a hint of irony, declared that it would punish anyone who spoke against the rights of man, even as these rights included freedom of speech. The French revolutionaries had not only exported their fine principles, but also their deep disagreements over what those principles actually meant in practice. As we come back to again and again, freedom of expression generally has a hard time thriving in the context of war. And the Batavian Republic was no exception. As the Napoleonic Wars raged on, the relative freedom experienced by the Dutch in the 1790s was under constant pressure, both from their own government and their French overlords. Challenged by the government, the democratically elected councils of the Republic fought fiercely to retain their hard-won freedoms, especially the freedom of the press, which they argued had often proved to be essential for making the government accountable to the general public. But in 1801, the game was up. As a final move in the ongoing struggle between the executive and legislative branch of government, the executive mounted a coup d'état, effectively ending the experiment of democracy in the Netherlands. Less than a year later, on the 18th of June 1802, the chief of internal police, Abraham Jacques Lapierre, a notorious enemy of the press throughout the Batavian Republic, reportedly took pleasure in finally forcing all existing political periodicals to close down. And just 4 years later, the Dutch Republic came to its end. The Republic, which for more than two centuries had been a powerhouse of radical thought, popular politics, and the European Enlightenment, was converted by Napoleon into a puppet kingdom under the rule of his brother and reduced to a mere outpost of the French Empire. A century after the Glorious Revolution, according to the young Prime Minister William Pitt, Britain enjoyed the best constitution that was ever formed on the habitable globe, with its measured balance between law, liberty, and order. But the French Revolution and its fresh new principles of human rights caused many Britons to reconsider whether the balance had become skewed in favor of crown, nobility, established religion, and property, at the expense of democracy, tolerance, freedom, and equality. Nothing better symbolizes the battle of ideas that would shake British society to its core than the so-called Pamphlet Wars and its aftermath. The Pamphlet War began on November 4, 1789, some 4 months after the storming of the Bastille. The London Revolutionary Society celebrated the centenary of the Glorious Revolution, and the Welsh dissenter, Reverend Price, gave a speech. Price saw an obvious analogy between the Glorious Revolution and the events unfolding in Paris, which he believed were foreshadowing the dawn of a new era.
Behold, all ye friends of freedom, behold the light you have struck out after setting America free, reflected to France and there kindled into a blaze that lays despotism in ashes and warms and illuminates Europe. I see the ardor for liberty catching and spreading, the dominion of kings change for the dominion of laws, and the dominion of priests giving way to the dominion of reason and conscience.
Price published the speech under the title A Discourse on the Love of Our Country, and before long copies were circulating in America, Dublin, and Paris. A year later, a very loud response came from the MP Edmund Burke. Today, his Reflections on the Revolution in France is regarded as the foundational document of conservatism. But Burke was a Whig, not a Tory, and had supported the American revolutionaries, favored religious toleration of Catholics in Ireland, and was critical of British imperialism in India. So reflections stunned many in the pro-reform camp. This is not the place to explore the ideas of Burke in any detail, but central to his utter disgust at the French Revolution was his deep opposition to the philosophical premise of abstract human rights. To Burke, institutions and rights had to be concretely grounded in tradition, reflecting the experience and wisdom of past generations. This had been the great achievement of the Glorious Revolution, which, according to Burke, built on precedents stretching back to Magna Carta. The French Revolution was a very different beast, constructed on the shifting sand of pure reason. The very idea of the fabrication of a new government is enough to fill us with disgust and horror, he wrote. And the Declaration of Man was a digest of anarchy. Having worked himself into a frenzy, Burke concluded,
"Massacre, torture, hanging, these are your rights of men. These are the fruits of metaphysic declarations wantonly declared."
He also defended strict social and political hierarchy and attacked the swinish multitude who had downtrodden the royal prerogatives of Louis XVI, producing an insolent irreligion in opinions. In contrast, Burke praised the cold sluggishness of the British national character.
"We are not the converts of Rousseau. We are not the disciples of Voltaire. Ilvicheuse has made no progress amongst us. Atheists are not our preachers. Madmen are not our lawgivers."
Reflections sold an impressive 30,000 copies in 2 years and provoked an explosion of new pamphlets for and against, out of which crystallized political principles and positions still with us today. Among those triggered by Burke was Mary Wollstonecraft. Her response, A Vindication of the Rights of Men, was published less than 2 months after Burke's reflections. When she revealed her identity and put her name on the second edition, she was instantly invited to the radical circles of reformers. But it was her next pamphlet that really caught her readers' attention. Changing her initial title to A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, she followed Olympe de Gouges and advocated for universal rights, not just for all men, but for women too. Another response to Burke came from the prominent scientist, political philosopher, and renegade preacher Joseph Priestley. As the founding father of Unitarianism, he was a personal victim of laws discriminating Protestant dissenters and Catholics. Despite being a gifted scientist, he was barred from holding public offices and teaching at prestigious universities like Oxford and Cambridge. Not surprisingly, he supported the French Revolution wholeheartedly, and in 1791 he published his Letters to the Right Honorable Edmund Burke. In language that must have revolted Burke, he claimed that the American and French Revolutions marked a totally new and most wonderful and important era in the history of mankind. He also expressed his deep disappointment that Burke now suddenly seemed to defend the discrimination of religious dissenters to protect the Anglican Church. "What we most of all wish, and what you have the greatest reason to dread, is not any temporal power or influence. What Priestley demanded was instead the free discussion of everything relating to religion." But Price would pay the price for his outspokenness. On the second anniversary of the storming of the Bastille, Loyalist rioters destroyed Priestley's house, library, and scientific laboratory in Birmingham, and he fled to London with his family. But he remained in danger until he fled to Pennsylvania with his family in 1794, where he would spend the rest of his life. This intolerant mob action was but a small foretaste of the avalanche about to be triggered by an even more outspoken defender of the French Revolution. For the reply to Burke that everyone was waiting for was that of Thomas Paine. As you'll remember, his common sense had caused a mass conversion of Americans to the idea of independence. Paine was also an enthusiastic supporter of the French Revolution and felt betrayed by what he saw as his old friend Burke's hyperbolic and reactionary defense of despotism and obscurantist religion. To Paine, all men were created equal with natural rights to freedom. When government violated the rights of men, the people had a right to resist and overthrow their illegitimate rulers. He also claimed, not entirely correctly, that revolutionary France had abolished both tolerance and intolerance in favor of the much more progressive principle of universal freedom of conscience.
Tolerance is not the opposite of intolerance, but is the counterfeit of it. Both are despotisms. The one assumes to itself the right of withholding liberty of conscience, and the other of granting it. The one is the Pope armed with fire and faggot, and the other is the Pope selling or granting indulgences.
Paine thrust a brilliant rhetorical dagger into the very heart of the British political system with its aristocracy, which deteriorated the human species. He found the very idea of hereditary legislators as absurd as an hereditary mathematician or an hereditary wise man. So who won the debate? Well, I guess that depends on your politics. But if we're talking popularity, Burke was Cliff Richard and Paine the Beatles. As mentioned, Burke's Reflections sold 30,000 copies in the first 2 years. But Paine had sold 50,000 copies after 3 months, and according to a conservative estimate, Rights of Man sold between 100 and 200,000 copies in the first 3 years. It was perhaps the most widely published book in history, apart from the Bible, at the time. Burke refused to reply directly to the substance of Paine's arguments.
I will not attempt in the smallest degree to refute them. This will probably be done, if such writings shall be thought to deserve any other than the refutation of criminal justice, by others.
Burke had rightly predicted that the French Revolution would descend into violence, and his suggestion that Paine be dealt with by criminal justice also proved prophetic. But initially the government, after careful deliberations, stayed its hand. No need to make Paine a martyr like John Wilkes, and since Rights of Man sold at an expensive 3 shillings, the government hoped it wouldn't spread to the lower classes and incite radical ideas. But in February 1792, Paine followed up with his Rights of Man secondary part. In it, he significantly upped the seditious ante. He now took firm aim at the hereditary monarchy and turned Burke's arguments on its head. Burke accused abstract human rights of leveling society. But Paine now claimed that it was in fact hereditary monarchy that was a leveling system, since it put people on the throne based on their blood and regardless of their vices or virtues. This explained
the abject state of the human mind in monarchical countries. In short, we cannot conceive a more ridiculous figure of government than hereditary succession in all its cases presents.
That would include the mentally unstable King George III, or his Majesty, as Paine called him. Paine's sensational book gave powerful ammunition to the many corresponding and constitutional societies that had sprung up since 1790, working for parliamentary reforms to strengthen democracy and toleration. These societies increasingly targeted the middle and lower classes to foster popular support for their demands, which deeply worried the government. And as Paine's ideas spread like wildfire, the government reconsidered its toleration of Paine's propaganda. Not only was the French Revolution getting more and more radical by the day, but the recent memories of the deadly anti-Catholic Gordon riots in the 1780s, the humiliating loss of the American colonies at the hand of the ragtag army and printing presses of the American colonists, and the paper bullets that had helped incite the English civil wars in the 1640s following the collapse of censorship, may also have helped persuade Pitt that a line had to be drawn. And now the gloves were off. Pitt struck back with a 1-2 punch in shape of a criminal charge for seditious libel against Paine and a royal proclamation against seditious writings and publications. It warned against
wicked and seditious writings that have been printed, published, and industriously dispersed, tending to excite tumult and disorder by endeavoring to raise groundless jealousies and discontents in the minds of our faithful and loving subjects.
In Parliament, Pitt explained why Paine was now an enemy of the state. His ideas struck at hereditary nobility and went to the destruction of monarchy and religion and the total subversion of the established form of government.
Magistrates were ordered to hunt down authors and printers of sedition. This led to a flurry of arrests and around 200 prosecutions for seditious libel in the 1790s, most of which took place in early 1793. Tom Paine biographer John Keane vividly describes the persecutorial atmosphere created.
The royal proclamation set off official hunts against political heresy from one end of the country to another. Government spies were assigned to the popular societies to monitor and obstruct their activities. Bill stickers were imprisoned for posting notices in favor of Paineite reforms. Bookshops selling rights of man were visited and harassed by agents of the book police and sometimes arrested, prosecuted, fined, or imprisoned. Richard Phillips, who published the pro-reform Leicester Herald, was convicted for a year and a half for allegedly selling the book. Public places frequented by Paine sympathizers were carefully monitored and sometimes harassed. In the villages of Northamptonshire, house-to-house loyalty canvasses were conducted. In Wiltshire, traitorous expression earned a schoolmaster the sack. John Frost, the attorney activist in the London Corresponding Society, was arrested and sentenced to the pillory and to 18 months imprisonment on the pretext of a remark, "I am for equality, why no kings?" uttered in a Marylebone coffee house.
The government also launched a patriotic flag-waving campaign to win hearts and minds. Hundreds of loyalist societies were created to combat the Jacobin ideas of Paine and like-minded radicals. The government also sponsored writers to drag Paine's name through the gutter with lurid accounts of his private life and allegedly suspect business dealings. Newspapers thundered against Mad Tom in articles and demonizing cartoons. But most unnerving was the organized campaigns of hatred and symbolic murderous violence that took place in hundreds of towns all over the country in 1792 and 3. In January 1793, the Newcastle Chronicle could write that
Paine's effigy has been burnt, shot, hanged, and undergone the greatest marks of popular resentment in most towns and villages in this part of the country.
Paine himself was constantly followed by government spies wherever he went, which, given the general popular incitement against him, must have been intimidating to say the least. Ultimately, things got too hot for Paine, who managed to escape across the Channel to France, where he was greeted as a hero and became a member of the National Assembly. Though, as we've seen, that almost cost Paine his life. Exiling Paine was probably the government's plan all along. A long prison sentence or an execution would likely harden the revolutionary movement. But Paine was still tried in absentia. In the trial, the Attorney General explained that Rights of Man was written with a view to vilify, degrade, and to bring into abhorrence and contempt all the establishment of this country, and intended to make the lower orders of society disaffected to government. It was sneering and contemptuous, and in defiance to all law, morality, and religion. What made it especially alarming was that it was addressed to
that part of the public whose minds cannot be supposed to be conservant with subjects of this sort, the ignorant, the credulous, and the desperate.
The Attorney General specifically highlighted the most incriminating parts of Paine's work, including that all hereditary government is in its nature tyranny, that the Bill of Rights was a bill of wrongs and insults, and that the House of Lords operated against the general interest of the nation. Paine's defense attorney was the great Thomas Erskine. He gave a four-hour-long speech in defense of Paine, in which he argued against the limited Blackstonian conception of press freedom. "Every man is protected in his opinions. It is only his conduct that makes guilt," he insisted. And then,
"The freedom of the press of England, gentlemen, consists in this, that a man must not address to individuals upon the spur of some occasion opinions that shall provoke them to sedition, to insurrection and tumult, but he may freely address to the universal reason of a whole nation principles of government congenial with or hostile to the form of government under which he lives."
When the Attorney General got up to reply, the foreman of the jury told him he needn't bother, as the jury, which was handpicked from among the upper classes, had already reached their verdict. Paine was guilty as charged. But Erskine's defense had struck home with the people, and he was escorted home in triumph amid shouts of "Erskine and the rights of juries" and "Paine and the liberty of the press." In November 1792, Pitt ramped the repression up a notch further. Earlier that year in France, the king had been imprisoned, the monarchy abolished, and more than 1,000 prisoners massacred. To top it off, the increasingly radical French government promised armed support for anyone planning their own revolutions, and London was teeming with rumors of imminent uprising. And now it was Secretary of State Henry Dundas' turn to be burned in effigy by rowdy mobs. Things were getting out of hand. So Parliament adopted the so-called Aliens Act to protect the borders from French Fifth Column refugees and ordered a new round of beefed-up seditious libel prosecutions, which saw the arrest of those who sold rights of man. Despite the anti-Paine crusade, Pitt didn't press the big red emergency button until the Jacobins unleashed the terror in 1793 and the French declared war on Britain. When Louis XVI lost his head, Pitt immediately kicked out the French ambassador. He didn't negotiate with terrorists. Pitt's next step was to weed out homegrown revolutionaries, or so-called English Jacobins, whom he suspected were colluding with the French to incite a British revolution. And from 1793, Pitt initiated what his critics called the Reign of Terror. Pitt justified his emergency laws in a speech to the House of Commons.
The motion for reform was nothing more than the preliminary to the overthrow of the whole system of our present government. And if they succeed, they would overthrow the best constitution that was ever formed on the habitable globe.
But the burning question was, how much was going to be left of the best constitution on the habitable globe after Pitt was done protecting it? It should be said that historians like Jennifer Modi argues that Pitt and his ministers continually strive to balance liberty against order and constraint in order not to overreact. But from my perspective, that seems a pretty generous interpretation. While Pitt's reign of terror was nothing like the one unleashed in France, it still amounted to an orchestrated and systematic campaign against political speech. And in comparison, the American Sedition Act of 1798, with its fewer than 20 prosecutions, suddenly looks very mild indeed. On May 7, 1794, Pitt suspended the right to habeas corpus, a cornerstone of British liberty with roots stretching back to the Magna Carta of 1215. The police was unshackled and allowed to make warrantless arrests. When the revolutionary London Corresponding Society, which was founded by Thomas Hardy to appeal to the working class, organized a British convention in April, Pitt suspected the society was really planning a French invasion. Without habeas corpus to hold them back, police arrested Hardy and leading members of two other corresponding societies on suspicion of treason. But the prosecution failed to prove any connection between the societies and the French government, and in an embarrassment to the government, the defendants were acquitted and habeas corpus restored in June 1795, until suspended again in 1798. In the fall of 94, Pitt got new reasons for concern when riots broke out all over England after two bad harvests made food prices go through the roof. A London mob attacked the King's coach on its way to the opening of Parliament, and the King even claimed to have been shot at. Someone broke Pitt's window in Downing Street. The failure to convict Thomas Hardy for treason under existing laws caused Pitt to bring out the big guns. He drastically curtailed free speech and assembly with the so-called Gagging Acts rushed through in 1795, although both were temporary in nature. The Seditious and Treasonable Practices Act was to combat diverse wicked and seditious writings tending to excite tumult and disorder, and it widened the definition of treason to include any verbal or written attack on the king and his ministers. Augustus would have nodded approvingly. Montesquieu and Tacitus would have been horrified. The act also declared it a matter of treason to bring the king or his government into contempt. In other words, criticizing the monarchy and government was now considered treason and punishable by death. The Seditious Meeting Act aimed to suppress and prevent all riots, tumults, and other disorders, not only contrary to law, but dangerous to the most important interests of this kingdom. The law made it illegal for more than 50 persons to meet without a permit from a government official and gave justices of the peace jurisdiction to disperse any public meeting. Refusal to comply was also punishable by death. There were critics. The opposition leader Charles James Fox condemns Pitt's reign of terror and quit his position in Parliament in protest. But in 1797, Pitt took further steps to stop what Burke had called the swinish multitude from participating in political debates. He did so through a steep tax increase on all print and a requirement that printers slap their names and addresses on all publications. What couldn't be outright banned could be taxed so as to limit circulation to the better classes. Bold move, considering how the Stamp Act had radicalized American colonists. Then, in 1799, the last safe spaces for radicalism were closed down by the Corresponding Societies Act. The Act declared that a number of radical societies in England, Scotland and Ireland, including the London Corresponding Society and the United Irishmen, were utterly suppressed and prohibited as being unlawful combinations and confederacies against the government of our sovereign lord, the King. Over the course of the 18th century, freedom of speech had celebrated crucial victories, expanding the public sphere and serving as a battering ram of wider Enlightenment reforms of tolerance and representative government, from America to the Dutch Republic, France, and even Russia. But at the turn of the 18th century, this bulwark of liberty was now suddenly in full retreat everywhere, even America. Before, it had been probably entrenched and fully blossomed. And as we'll see in the next episode, draconian repression of popular demands for democratic and socio-economic reforms continued well into the 19th century. A stark reminder that the so-called Enlightenment value of free speech was by no means safe and secure at the end of the Enlightenment. Which begs the question of how safe and secure this fundamental value remains today, when once again supposedly liberal governments feel threatened by the exercise of freedom of speech. Thank you very much for listening. Today's episode was edited by Søren Støjhøj. Crucial research was provided by Mathias Meyer and the newest member of the Clear and Present Danger team, Lars Emil Nybo Nissen.